Great. Okay. So today is Wednesday, what is it, the 12th? Yeah.
Yes,
it's the 12th of May, 2010. And I'm Rick Hansen, obviously. And we did a meditation that followed the mindfulness of breathing meditation of the Buddha. Normally, I do not give anything like those number of suggestions. And I appreciate the fact that for some people, that's not your preference. For some people, I've heard it really is the preference. And what I'm doing is I'm following essentially those steps. They're, depending on how you count, 14 or 16 of them, those are the first seven, right? And so I don't think I'll do that again myself next time. We'll just have a more typical meditation. That said, remember last time we said that we would use this as a time to really talk somewhat about what is this business of the feeling tone and the movement from pleasant or unpleasant or neutral to liking, to wanting, to needing, to suffering, right? What's that flow? How does that flow work in your own life? What's all that mean? And what's the relationship of that to the other target of awareness in that sixth and seventh step that we went through today, perception, the labeling or categorizing of things, all right? So I just wanted to open it up to people who had questions or comments about those two things, particularly as they play a role in your own life. Yeah, please.
Well, last week we talked about the labeling.
Yeah.
And you were saying that the labeling of an emotion can be useful, and that in terms of Western psychology, the research shows that if you label the emotion, its power is lessened. And so I have found that to be the case for me when I'm meditating on my own.
Yeah.
And emotions are interfering. I may not even be aware that they are an emotion. And then when I do some investigating, what did you call it, the surgeon's tool? I discover it's an emotion and I label it and then it just kind of goes away.
All right. So you're talking about a beneficial aspect of perceiving.
As it relates to emotions.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's true for, I haven't done a thorough investigation.
No, it's great. It's great. Yeah.
I was going to try and differentiate, if you could, between being aware of something, recognizing something, and then being able to label it or actually attach a name to it.
Mm. Yeah. What's your experience of that?
They're different, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a phrase in brain science called processing stream that's useful somehow. In other words, something, either there's an outside event, like someone coughs or a door opens, right? A car horn blares, whatever. The person next to you starts snoring. Who knows? Okay? Or very often, there's some kind of an internal event. And then it just starts to tip its nose above the waterline into awareness. And then there's this stream that follows. And you can kind of be aware of that processing stream. And I think you're getting at, what's it like to allow mental contents to be there? And when does this sort of labeling function come in? Sort of memory. It's categorizing it. It's this, not that. It's connected to that. It's, you know, that's what that is, right? And I personally experienced that it's very powerful, actually, to imagine and to find your way into, to sense the kind of freedom and peace before excessive hedonic tone, feeling tone, comes in, and excessive, needless labeling that's very driven kind of out of an embedded panic by survival. Can you kind of feel that, right? Like, particularly when you start experimenting with the feeling tone quieting, you know, the seventh step that we did, tranquilizing the feeling tone or tranquilizing labeling, when that starts to quiet, you realize you're okay. You're not falling over, right? You know what to do with your body. You know how to adjust it. You know how to be. But there isn't so much that kind of tense or contracted quality of reactive labeling and liking or disliking things. Just kind of opening that up for you, you know, to explore and to experience. What's that like? You know, that kind of freedom and peace, fundamentally, prior to liking and disliking and labeling really getting going. Did anybody have any sense of that? And if so, can you talk about it? Yeah.
I don't know how this comes in, but it seems to me you may have done this in this group a year or two ago. I remember, for some reason, being prompted to think about, or not think about, that's an automobile. And I noticed human beings getting in these little metal boxes and going and winding up in different places.
Uh-huh.
And I thought it was marvelous that individuals like myself could get in a little box like that and wind up in a different place. Now, I don't know if that was fun. And in terms of happiness, it gave me some happiness to contemplate what was going on. End of comment.
Yeah. Well, there's a long tradition of people talking about the perils of conceptualizing. And perception is the beginning of conceptualizing, of abstracting. Yeah, automobile, and it very quickly goes to a category, which is a conceptualization. That's an abstraction. And people often will talk about, as soon as we start to do that, we are already at that point one step removed from experience.
So I'm questioning, what is the value, why is it advised to
tranquilize it?
Formations arise.
You mean, you're looking at the note there, why tranquilize it, why relax it?
I can see that. That would be good, yeah.
Tranquilize.
That's what it's called. By the way, why don't we do this? I'll hand out these sheets, and you're very welcome to take them with you, use them for guides at home or not. You can leave them here too if you like. They're more than enough here. Anyway, and you can see that the first set there, we did here, and that's what, Bill, you're talking about, right? So what's your question? Your question is, what's the value? What do you think in the Buddha's advice here that we should train to, you know, breathe in or breathe out, tranquilizing, feeling and perception? Right? Is that what your question is? What value was there for anyone here at that point in the meditation? Yeah, Harold.
Well, I think when you start labeling, you're starting to think. You're starting to not be in the moment. You're not ready for what's next because you're already thinking about what happened already.
Yeah. Anybody else?
Relaxing.
Kind of relaxing. Yeah. Yeah.
I find that after driving here and grinding free from work, and I had a board meeting before coming here, by the time I get here, I sit down and I'm basically a mess. And so,
come to the right place.
If I just simply wait around for things to die down, it takes a while.
Yeah.
But I find that almost anything, any sort of simple practice occupies me to the point where there's not enough left over to get into trouble. Do you know what I mean? And so I found this evening that was a practice that worked very simply and directly, watching the flow of judgment, the feeling tone. And then I realized almost with a start, wow, hey, that was great. That was, it calmed me down much more quickly than simply waiting.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah.
So your question is, what's the advantage of the relaxation before the laboring and the rest of the
thing stream? Or in effect, why do you think the Buddha put this in? Why do you think he said you should train thus? Train thus. Breathing in, breathing out, tranquilizing the feeling tone, and tranquilizing perception. That's kind of the question. Yeah. Do you want to take a crack at your own answer?
Well,
Well, for me, that is so important because the rest can happen so fast. That processing stream can go from that initial label of a potato chip to wanting it for survival in like a second.
I know, and getting angry at other people who are eyeing the bag.
So to break it, maybe to relax first, to be able to break that down into the steps that you mentioned.
Yeah.
Instead of just slide.
Yeah.
Detached engagement of a concept or percept.
Say that again?
Detached engagement.
Right, you're saying that's the kind of the point, you think?
I mean, I think that that's a benefit.
Right. Harold? Yeah.
I also think it's to be able to not go to the labeling is the skill of mindfulness. That's one of the things you're developing.
Okay. Right. Great. Yeah. How about you? And then you? Yeah.
It seems like the point is for the thoughts to not adhere in a way to where, so, you know, it's like a little strategy. And what I notice in my meditation, because it goes through all these permutations, that when my concentration is strong enough, then the thoughts don't appear, and they kind of bounce off. And then there's this other kind of awareness that it just feels calming and sustaining, and then it feels like the thoughts that generate from that are more like insights, or they're a different quality. Have that, like, oh, I got to hang on to that. It's there, they seem to release energy, and you can let them go easier. And it's like, oh, you know, it's like, this is helpful, you know, it's like, very different quality than initially just being bombarded by all the stuff of the mind from the, you know, conditioning of survival throughout the day and life and everything.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. How about you?
I find the tranquilizing, the conscious effort to tranquilize very, very helpful. Because when I start to sit, the first thing that comes up usually is an inability to do it at all. And then housekeeping stuff, like, oh, I forgot to. And then the mind starts to present things. The image that came to mind was like a kid laying out favorite toys. It wants to contemplate things that it likes. And the more the tranquilization is focused on, it seems to produce a spot where, as the mind comes up with other things, rather than having to fight them, as it comes up with, oh, how about this? It's kind of, it's not an annoyance exactly, but it's like an interruption of a very peaceful in serene states, so there's no valence really to go into it.
Yes.
And that's a new spot for me. That's nice.
Right. That's kind of the, in a way, I think you're getting right at it. I mean, I think one of the benefits of being able to actually tranquilize this, the urgency, really, of this feeling tone with associated labeling is to get a taste of freedom. Get a taste of the mind without this machine of feeling tone perception leading to craving, clinging, and suffering. Right? And so I ask you, you know, to the extent that you were able to accomplish, even for a moment, that sense of relative, at least, tranquilization of the feeling tone and perception, what was that state of mind like?
Couple of examples of what I interpret that tranquilization to be in specific context. I find myself when I start falling asleep that previously I would react to that, which is to say I'd get down on myself or tell myself not to fall asleep. Now when I start falling asleep, I just use it in order to just calm down and give up processing, and I find that I achieve peace through not reacting to the fact that I'm falling asleep.
Yeah.
I also do the same thing when I hear noise, because when I'm at home, there's a certain amount of noise that goes on. And like the heater here, you know.
Yeah.
So the heater here kicks in and it wakes me up. So I don't react to say, oh, the heater, or oh, the garbage truck, or my kids, or whatever it is. They've kind of done me a service, because basically they've woken me up, because I'm probably involved in some thinking process. And I use it almost like the stick in a Zen practice. And so without reacting to it, it actually helps me, even though if I was not tranquil, I would resent it or react to it in some way. So those are a couple of examples.
Okay, great. Okay, good. Yeah, in the back.
The biggest thing I notice is I reach a point of spaciousness where anything is possible and everything is held. And all that other crap I was thinking of doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
You know, nothing really matters. And that's a deep freedom.
Right.
Because the mind tends to make everything so significant.
Yeah.
So that's a nice freedom to have.
Right. Good. Maybe one more person? Yeah, right there. Yeah.
And how this anticipatory disquiet before an event, you know, like I find myself like creating anxiety before things happen. And so, I mean, this, and then you brought in this more blessing disposition. But, you know,
right.
Does that help to tranquilize it, this anticipatory?
Right. So let me, if I could, rewind and unpack a little bit, okay? So for starters, well, just think for a moment, if you could, about the amount of time you spend, and just do it for a moment. So start thinking about or anticipating something that's concerning to you, and notice the amount of sort of anticipatory unpleasantness or discomfort, anticipatory discomfort that the mind generates. So just think about a situation in your life and just watch your mind just kind of ruminate on it. We'll just do it for half a minute here. And in particular, try to track this thing about anticipatory discomfort. Like what it would be like to not get certain things done? Or what it would be like if certain things happen? Or if certain people say certain things to you or act in certain ways, or you have to deal with something. I mean, to the extent you could do that process, there was probably a little micro moments of unpleasantness. And now let's do it the other way. Kind of let your mind sort of think about or plan or in something that you look forward to, something that has a lot of anticipatory pleasantness or comfort to it. You know, getting home at the end of the day, relaxing, you know, the nice things you want to do, the sorbet you want to have before going to bed, the really interesting novel you're reading you want to read because you want to reward yourself for having done a lot of work today. You know? Whatever, just do that. You know, or getting something done that you're almost getting done. Just, again, watch the anticipatory rewards or pleasantness running through the mind. Okay? So, what did you notice? In particular, what comes right after the anticipatory pleasant reward or the anticipatory unpleasant pain or penalty. What happens next?
I don't know what happens next, but I know my breathing was completely different. It was really shallow, constricted, and then it was really full with the happy experience.
Yeah.
Completely.
Yeah. Can you?
And that led to feeling different, more sensation.
In other words, can you see your mind very quickly go into planning and problem solving, following pleasant or unpleasant, and wanting and, you know, and kind of contracting around it with a fair amount of, in the processing stream, selfing, emerging behind the parade. Right? Can you see that? Even on a time scale of a few seconds. You know, your mind's wandering and then it latches onto something, something you're thinking about, pleasant or unpleasant. The pleasantness or unpleasantness constellate, congeal in the processing stream. Then what follows? Right? Some kind of, right?
Well, you feel it in your body.
Yeah.
You both of them.
And does it ever, you know, does it, how often does it just stay pleasant flowing through, unpleasant flowing through? The busy little beaver upstairs wants to help you survive, right? Wants to pass on his genes, wants to get through the day, and it gets going, right? That's the Buddha's teaching of dependent origination, right? Stimulus occurs, there's contact with it, then there's the feeling tone, accompanied typically by a perception, some label, and then the business begins, right? Craving, clinging, suffering. And I think the point of this practice is to appreciate the largely arbitrary and mechanical and endless and mostly meaningless nature of feeling and perceiving. And how rapidly, you know, suffering begins. And to give us a taste of freedom when that machinery is fairly quieted. Yeah.
Is the machinery quiet, or are we just not playing along?
Well, that's a great question. I think the sixth step, we're to experience the machinery in a mindful space. So it's there, it's fully in gear, but we're just aware of it and kind of decoupled from it. Right? And I think there also are, like, these are mostly micro examples, like you just did a moment ago for 30 seconds. Sometimes there are major macro examples. Let's say someone is grappling with sobriety, you know, an alcoholic, let's say, who is anticipating the pleasure of going to the bar with, let's say it's a guy, his buddies, watching the game and pounding a few beers, or more than a few beers, right? That's where life really is, isn't it? Right? And you know, in a broad way, the person, let's say, knows, wait, that's addict mind talking, don't go there. So that would be, the machinery is running, but we're not buying into it. Or someone's walking through a mall, they see a really neat sweater or top they want, and they look, they know it's $120 and not a good thing to spend money on right now. So they're aware of it and they don't get carried away by it. But then in the seventh step, we're to tranquilize it, which, you know, can mean different things in the translation, but it basically means to quiet it down. Yeah. And at that point, we're quieting it down to the maximum degree possible, including having moments, I think, of where it's just not running. And that's such an interesting state in the mind. Yeah, so I think that's the answer to your question.
I mean, isn't the idea that if you don't feed it, it kind of calms down. There's not the circuit.
It's as I think you were getting at, it's to truly have insight on the ground with the mind that's quiet enough to really appreciate the degree to which suffering follows the feeling tone. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The feeling tone, and in the brain, in evolution, you know, the feeling tone kept our ancestors alive. It told them, eat carrots, run from sticks, right? And hold tight to us and fear and kill them. That's what it did, and it was really successful. And we are their great-grandchildren sitting on top of the food chain, you know? But that said, it leads to endless rounds of suffering. I think that's the point. The point is primarily is insight. And then it's also, over time, to train the mind so that there's less urgency in the feeling tone. And there's less being caught up in conceptual labeling. Yeah, that's my view. See what you think. That's my opinion.
Well, I mean, yeah, there's less pull. You're not holding on to it. You're not feeding it.
Yeah. That combo, and you can even watch it, just one sec. If you like, what comes first, the feeling tone or perception? Now, in your mind, I think, at least in my mind, I see that very often what actually comes first is the feeling tone. And I've often wondered why the Buddha put that first when he listed the five aggregates, the five skandhas, or heaps of experience. You know, there's form, feeling tone, perception, you know, volitional formations, the other contents of awareness, and then awareness itself or consciousness itself. And I think it's because in evolution, and you can see this when you're walking, you know, the famous example in the Buddha, is you're walking down a path and you suddenly jump back and there's this vague sense of a shape in front of you. You have no idea, but alarm bells ring and you jump back. You know, jump first, label later. Right? So that's why I think feeling comes first, because it's critical for survival. While you're trying to figure out, is that a steak, a stick or a snake? Back off, you know? You know, my point about that is that this process happens a lot, right? It's very automatic. It's very ongoing. And it's really powerful to just take a minute or so in your day and walk down a street and just watch all the feeling tones that are arising and get a sense of how those continually, it's like the puppet master. Or to give you kind of a graphic example, imagine that you're a fish and you've got one hook in this side of your mouth and another hook in that side of your mouth, right? You know, greed, hatred, pulling you one way or another as you walk down the sidewalk, right? It's like that fast and that continual and, you know, that fraught with suffering, particularly if we're not conscious of it. When we're conscious of it, then it's nothing. It's far out. It's just coming in, coming out. We're not hijacked by it. You know, we're not, as you said, caught up in it. But to do that, I mean, yeah, it's useful to notice macro feeling tone, macro pleasant, macro liking, wanting, needing, right? But a lot of where the action is in the granularity of events that last a few seconds or so. And that's why I think this practice is so important, to slow it down. That's why I think another reason tranquilizing helps, because it slows it down. So, you know, you're seeing it like that.
How can a fish with a hook in each side of its mouth not get caught up by it unless it was an open mouth smile?
There you go. Now that's really lovely. So that's right. So if you're smiling with it, you're not so carried by it. You know. Yeah. Okay.
So what is a neutral feeling tone?
That's a wonderful question. So I've had an important teacher for me, Christina Feldman, and she really emphasizes the neutral feeling tone as a very important target of practice. Later, probably starting in July, we'll really go deeply into mindfulness of feeling, which is the second foundation of mindfulness. And we'll also engage questions around what is equanimity, because equanimity is a critical factor in Buddhism of peace, freedom from suffering, and awakening. All right? So the neutral is really important. And Christina talked about it, as she said, a doorway to the eventless. That is a weird phrase. Now, we're under yellow flag here because she's saying something like the eventless, as if there is a thing that is the eventless. And this gets into real thin ice and controversy in Buddhism about whether there are some ultimate things like the unconditioned, the deathless, the eventless, nibbana. See? So you have to be kind of careful about that. But, you know, you can imagine the eventless, if you will, as in different ways. One is the allness altogether itself never changes. That's pretty far out to kind of get that, right? Little contents within it, parts of it change, but the allness as allness never actually changes. Whoa. Another way to relate to eventless is in terms of the nature of things. In other words, not as a thing, but as the nature of things. And that nature doesn't change. So in effect, there are no events there. You know? And beyond that, a way to understand the eventless is in the classical definition as nibbana. You know? Because anything that is an event is impermanent, conditionally arising, and has the mark of suffering. Whereas nibbana is talked about as, it's like where nothing happens, and you'll see descriptions of it, like where the sun doesn't rise, the moon doesn't set, it's just eventless. So, but I think what Christina's getting at there is that tracking the neutral, where like nothing is happening, and it's almost like, from my experience, is it's when I'm tracking the neutral, it's almost like the mind stops. It's like a moment of kensho, or just stepping out of the stream. And then you notice you've stepped out of the stream, and it's pleasant to step out of the stream, and you're in the stream again as soon as you notice it, right? But play around with that. Play around with that. And then watch what happens when there is something that's neutral. It's like the mind is always looking for something to want or fear. So when there's neutral, it starts to panic because it's like it's missing something. It's missing a problem or it's missing an opportunity. Better get going. The little lizard, that industrious rat inside the head. I love that little rat, but he, she, it causes so much trouble. You know? Right? You can feel that inner rat. And if it can't find something to want, it really gets getting panicky. And some people are more like, if it can't find something to fear, it gets really nervous. Whereas other people are more like, it can't find something to want. You know, my inner rat really wants to find problems to solve. And if it can't find a problem to solve, it will make a problem to solve. All right. Yeah. And then Linda, too, wanted to say something. Yeah.
I was thinking, you know, with these feelings, how they relate to the, you know, aversion and clinging and,
that's right.
You know, and grasping.
Grasping the pleasant,
that
yeah.
Whole phase in that as well. And I never thought that, well, I'm just seeing, wondering how those correlate. And because I remember listening to these tapes of Jack's about psychological types related to this.
Yes.
And the one that was neither grasping nor clinging was also a problem state in that it tended to be spaced out.
Yeah, diluted.
Nine on the Enneagram.
Yeah.
So that was delusion. So, but you're presenting it like it's a little, it's not delusion, but it's a place where you either launch one way or the other.
Where I think it fuels spacing out or dissociating, delusion, if you will, is because there's nothing there to hold on to, so people then kind of go off. Mm-hmm. But I think it's also important, and then we'll come back to what you're saying, I guess, the Buddhist definition of it is also, he didn't use the word neutral. He said neither pleasant nor unpleasant. And that's very interesting to reflect on what that might be. Yeah.
But you're associating with like also nibbana or something like a specific state.
It's
and I'm wondering, it didn't seem to indicate that. Just, you know.
Well, what I'm saying is that I think that's a great point you're making. Typically, and I think that what happens when the mind hits something neutral, it starts to panic a little bit, and it starts worrying that it's missing a threat or an opportunity, and regenerates that. Or it encounters boredom, or it's not stimulating. And again, people vary temperamentally in terms of how much stimulation they want.
Could it also be a defensive place of going, of avoiding either.
Yeah, I think like a numbing.
A state of indolence or like a...
Yeah. Now, I love that you said that because I've never thought of that. But I think that's actually true. I think some people, you know, seek the neutral, which really means they seek the numbness. Yeah. Or they seek the dissociation.
I was thinking like the Enneagram.
Or they default to it. Yeah.
You know, on the Enneagram, it's sort of caught in between these two extremes. And its position is just to see all sides, the obsessive. You know, I can't make a choice because it's just flooded with everything.
Yeah. Yeah, so to recap kind of quickly, because we want to move to a wrap here in a few minutes, you know, the neutral, as you're saying, is actually really worth exploring, and that's exactly what I encourage you to play around with this week. Look how much, most experience is actually neutral. It's just stuff. I remember I had when I was in college, my primary girlfriend was first generation Chinese American, and I went to her house one time, which was, you know, it was really an interesting experience because, you know, it was like a terrible thing that a Chinese woman had an American boyfriend, you know, so I was disguised. It was a disguised identity. So anyway, in any case, and we were talking with her. I remember talking with her sister about rice, and I didn't care about rice. I said, rice, you know, has no taste. It's neutral, right? It's neither pleasant nor unpleasant. And she said, you drink water, don't you? And I thought that was so interesting. So a lot of life is like that. It's like white rice, you know. It's like water. It's like tofu or something, you know. It's just sort of neither pleasant nor unpleasant. Okay, so A, we're talking about how the mind, the little inner rat, that industrious rat, you know, gets really busy around the neutral, okay? The second thing we're seeing, I think you were bringing up really wonderfully, is how the degree to which some people tend to incline toward the neutral for many reasons. Maybe just the kind of numbness of depression or trauma or dissociative tendency, et cetera, et cetera. And then also what I think Christina Feldman was getting at is that the sense of the neutral, and particularly if you can abide in the neutral state, it can be a doorway to the eventless. It's not the eventless itself. It's not to be mistaken for the eventless, but it is kind of an interesting doorway. You know, because if you think in part, it's prior to these engines of craving and clinging, just the neutral moment. It's like a taste of things. Oh. Did you want to say anything or the moment? Okay, great. So how about we sit with this, all right? Just for 1 minute, and then we'll wrap up. So two investigations this week, if you like. Investigating the neutral feeling tone and investigating anticipation. Anticipating the pleasant, anticipating the unpleasant, and what happens. Thank you.
Could I just make one?